And welcome to Tesla's first quarter 2025 Q&A webcast. My name is Travis Axelrod, Head of Investor Relations, and I'm joined today by Elon Musk, Vaibhav Taneja, and a number of other executives. Our Q1 results were announced at about 3:00 P.M. Central Time in the update deck we published at the same link as this webcast. During this call, we will discuss our business outlook and make forward-looking statements. These comments are based on our predictions and expectations as of today. Actual events or results could differ materially due to a number of risks and uncertainties, including those mentioned in our most recent filings with the SEC. During the question-and-answer portion of today's call, please limit yourself to one question and one follow-up. Please use the raise hand button to join the question queue. Before we jump into Q&A, Elon will be providing an update. Elon?
Hello, everyone. It's never a dull moment these days. One thing's for sure, every day is going to be exciting. As some people know, there's been some blowback for the time that I've been spending in government with the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. I think the work that we're doing there is actually very important for trying to rein in the insane deficit that is leading our country, the United States, to destruction. The DOGE team has made a lot of progress in addressing waste and fraud. The natural blowback from that is those who were receiving the wasteful dollars and the fraudulent dollars will try to attack me and DOGE team and anything associated with me. I'm really left with two choices. Should we just let the waste and fraud continue? It was continuing to grow at a really unsustainable pace that was bankrupting the country, or to fight the waste and fraud and try to get the country back on the right track. I believe the right thing to do is to just fight the waste and fraud and get the country back on the right track and working together with President Trump and his administration. Because if the ship of America goes down, we all go down with it, including Tesla and everyone else. I think this is critical work. Now, the protests that you'll see out there, they're very organized. They're paid for. They're obviously not going to admit that the reason that they're protesting is because they're receiving fraudulent money or that they're the recipients of wasteful largesse. They're going to come up with some other reason. That is the real reason for the protests. The actual reason is that those receiving the waste and fraud wish to continue receiving it. That is the real thing that's going on here, obviously. Now, that said, I do think there's the large slug of work necessary to get the DOGE team in place and working in the government to get the financial house in order is mostly done. I think starting probably in next month, May, my time allocation to DOGE will drop significantly. I'll have to continue doing it for, I think, probably the remainder of the president's term, just to make sure that the waste and fraud that we stop does not come roaring back, which we'll do if it has the chance. I think I'll continue to spend a day or two per week on government matters for as long as the president would like me to do so and as long as it is useful. Starting next month, I'll be allocating far more of my time to Tesla. Now that the major work of establishing the Department of Government Efficiency is done. At Tesla, we've gone through many a crisis over the years and actually been through many near-death experiences. I think we're probably on the ragged edge of death, at least maybe a dozen times. It's been so many times. This is not one of those times. We're not on the ragged edge of death, not even close. But you know, there are some challenges, and I expect that this year will be there'll probably be some unexpected bumps this year. But I remain extremely optimistic about the future of the company. The future of the company is fundamentally based on large-scale autonomous cars, and large-scale, in large volume, vast numbers of autonomous humanoid robots. So the value of a company that makes truly useful autonomous humanoid robots and autonomous useful vehicles at scale, at low cost, which is what Tesla is going to do, is staggering. I continue to believe that Tesla, with excellent execution, will be the most valuable company in the world by far. But that's an important if. We must execute well. If we do execute well, I think Tesla will be the most valuable company in the world by far. It may be as valuable as the next five companies combined. So, but there'll be a few bumps along the road before that happens. I said, I think on the last earnings call, that you know that we'll start to see the prosperity of autonomy take effect in a material way around the middle of next year. We expect to have be selling fully autonomous rides in June in Austin, as we've been saying for now several months. So that's continued. But the real question from a financial standpoint is, when does it really become material and affect the bottom line of the company, and start to be a fundamental part when does it move the financial needle in a significant way? That's probably around the middle of next year, second half of next year. And then once it does start move the financial needle in a significant way, it will really go exponential from there. So that's, I'd encourage people to look beyond like the, you know, some sort of bumps and potholes of the road immediately ahead of us, but lift your gaze to the bright shining, you know, citadel on a hill. I don't know, some Reagan-esque imagery, that's where we're headed, and not too distant future, like I said. And the next year, technically. So, let's see. With respect to supply chain risk, something that Tesla has been working on for several years is to localize supply chains. This actually makes sense from a cost standpoint, from a logistics risk standpoint. Is to have the supply chains be at least located on the continent in which the car is built. And so we are, I think, the least affected car company with respect to tariffs, at least in most respects. I mean, it remains to be seen. Now tariffs are still, you know, tough on a company when margins are still low. But we do have localized supply chains in North America, Europe, and China. So that puts us in a stronger position than any of our competitors. And I undoubtedly, I'm going to get a lot of questions about tariffs. And I just want to emphasize that the tariff decision is entirely up to the President of the United States. I will weigh in with my advice with the President, which he will listen to my advice, but then it's up to him, of course, to make his decision. I've been on the record many times as saying that I believe lower tariffs are generally a good idea for prosperity. But this decision is fundamentally up to the elected representative of the people, being the President of the United States. So, I'll continue to advocate for lower tariffs rather than higher tariffs, but that's all I can do. So now let me walk you through why I'm so excited about the future of Tesla. So first of all, autonomy. The team and I are laser focused on bringing Robotaxi to Austin in June. Unsupervised autonomy will first be solved for the Model Y in Austin. And then we should parse out the terms robotic taxi or rubber taxi and just generally like what's the cyber cab, because we've got a product called the cyber cab, and then but any Tesla which could be an S3, X, or Y that is autonomous is a robotic taxi or robo taxi. It's very confusing. So the vast majority of the Tesla fleet that we've made is capable of being a robo taxi or robotic taxi. As we're going from, once we can make the system work where you can have paid rides fully autonomously with no one in the car in one city, that is a very scalable thing for us to go broadly within whatever jurisdiction allows us to operate. So because what we're solving for is a general solution to autonomy, not a city-specific solution for autonomy, once we make it work in a few cities, we can basically make it work in all cities in that legal jurisdiction. So once we can make it basically work in a few cities in America, we can make it work anywhere in America. Once we can make it work in a few cities in China, can work anywhere in China, likewise in Europe, limited only by regulatory approvals. So this is the advantage of having a generalized solution using artificial intelligence and an AI chip that Tesla designed specifically for this purpose, as opposed to very expensive sensors and high precision maps of a particular neighborhood where that neighborhood may change or often changes, and then the car stops working. So we have a general solution instead of a specific solution. Then regard to Optimus, making good progress in Optimus. We expect to have thousands of Optimus robots working in Tesla factories by the end of this year, doing useful work. We expect to scale Optimus up faster than any product, I think, in history. To get to millions of units per year as soon as possible. I think feel confident in getting to a million units per year in less than 5 years, maybe 4 years. So by 2030, I feel confident in predicting a million Optimus units per year. It might be 2029. So let's see, with respect to energy, our energy business is doing very well. The Megapack enables utility companies to output far more total energy than would otherwise be the case. When you think of the energy capability of a grid, it's much more than, say, total energy output per year. If the power plants could operate at peak power for all 24 hours, as opposed to being at half power or sometimes a quarter power at night, then you could double the energy output of existing power plants. But in order to do that, you need to buffer the energy so that you can charge up the something like battery pack at night and then discharge into the grid during the day. So this is a massive unlock on total energy output of any given grid over the course of a year. And utility companies are beginning to realize this and are buying in our mega packs at scale. So at this point, a gigawatt class battery is quite a common thing. So we're many orders in the hopper for gigawatt and beyond batteries. And we expect the energy, the stationary energy storage business to scale ultimately to terawatts per year. So very, very good numbers. Now, first quarters of a year are usually pretty tricky because it's usually the worst quarter of the year because people don't want to go buy a car in the middle of winter during a blizzard. So, we picked Q1 as like a good quarter to do a cutover to the new version of the Model Y, and we changed production of the world's best-selling cars. Worth remembering, the Model Y is the best-selling car of any kind on Earth, with a 1.1 billion unit per year output of a single model. And we did this changeover at the same time in factories all across the world. So congratulations to the Tesla team on an amazing job in pulling off what is a very difficult transition. It's really, that was very impressive work. In conclusion, while there are many near-term headwinds for us in the broader industry, the future for Tesla is brighter than ever. The value of the company is delivering sustainable abundance with our affordable AI-powered robots. So I like this phrase, sustainable abundance for all. If you say, like, what's the ideal future that you can imagine? That's what you'd want. You'd want abundance for all in a way that's sustainable. It's good for the environment. Basically, this is the happy future. If you say, what's the happiest future you could imagine? One which is, that would be a future where there's sustainable abundance for all. Closest thing to heaven we can get on Earth, basically. So thank you again to the Tesla team for all their efforts at the challenging time. And look forward to continuing to lead the team to great success in the future.
Great. Thank you very much, Elon. Before we move on, Vaibhav has some opening remarks as well.
Thanks, Elon. As Elon mentioned, in Q1, we achieved something which has never been undertaken in the automotive industry of updating all our factories for the best-selling car in the world all at the same time. And people don't understand, this was not a small feat. We're not aware of anybody else being able to do the best-selling car all at once within a quarter, and that too, hitting all the timelines which we had established at the beginning. So big kudos to the team for making this happen. Additionally, we also hit a record gross profit for energy storage business in the quarter. Now, getting back into the business, there's been a lot of speculation as to the reasons for decline of our vehicle deliveries in the first quarter. We had previously guided that we will be updating all factories, and this would lead to several weeks of lost production, which did happen as planned. The ripple effect of the change is not having enough new Model Y available in most markets for people to see and experience till the last few weeks of the quarter. Additionally, the negative impact of vandalism and unwarranted hostility towards our brand and our people had an impact in certain markets. Despite this, we were able to sell out legacy Model Y in US, China, and a few other markets within the world. And again, you know, just so people understand, we were producing the legacy Model Y till middle to end of February. And we switched over and we were able to still sell out within that period. So again, big achievement by all the people at Tesla to make it happen. We have a very extremely competitive vehicle lineup, which with most vehicles going through a recent update, and add to that advances in FSD, you have a personal chauffeur, which can take you almost anywhere under supervision. There are numerous stories shared by customers ranging from how it has improved their daily commute, to providing mobility to customers with disabilities, to giving older customers the ability to travel comfortably and independently. Not only is FSD supervised safer than a human driver, but it is also improving the lives of individuals who experience it. And again, this is something you have to experience, and anybody who has experienced just knows it. And you know, we've been doing a lot lately to try and get those stories out, at least on X, so that people can see how other people have benefited from this. Now, coming into some of the financial stuff, auto margins declined sequentially, primarily due to the reduction in the total number of deliveries, lower fixed cost absorption due to factory changeovers, and lower regulatory credit revenues, offset by a slight increase in pricing due to the launch of new Model Y, despite incentives which we had to sell legacy Model Y. Our energy storage business, like I said before, has achieved yet another milestone of great highest gross profit in the quarter. This was despite, you know, sequential decline in deployments. The importance of this business, as Elon mentioned, is pretty profound, especially in this environment, because, you know, if in order for grids to work properly with the demands from AI and all this, you need some more stability. And this is by far the simplest and best solution which we are aware of, which can help do this. And we've also developed certain unique solutions to help our customers to achieve this. Additionally, you know, on the Powerwall side, we've been selling the new Powerwall 3, and you know, it's been received with very good reception from customers, and to the extent that we are currently supply constrained. On services and other margins, they were slightly down sequentially, primarily because of the pressure on the used car business and insurance business. Note that we continued our journey to improve profitability in our services and collision business through better labor productivity. As previously discussed, our operating expenses continued to increase sequentially, primarily due to our AI-related initiatives, including Optimus, and also cost of development for vehicle programs, including CyberCab, Semi, and cheaper models. These expenses flow through R&D. We believe, even in the current environment, it is the right strategy in making investments in these areas to position us for the long term. These increases were offset by decreases in SG&A from changes in our vehicle referral program. Other income reduced significantly on a sequential basis. The primary reason was Bitcoin mark-to-market loss in Q1 versus gain in Q4, resulting in a $472 million draw. The remainder of the change is because of FX remeasurement. With the adoption of the new mark-to-market standard for Bitcoin, we expect increased volatility in other income in addition to the FX volatility. I know tariffs is the hottest topic which people talk about, and it has various impacts to our business. And as Elon mentioned, you know, on the vehicle business, we've been on this journey of regionalization for years. Specifically in the US, Model Y has been rated the most American model made car on cars.com made in America index 3 years in a row. This is part of all the work which the team has been doing over the years. And to the extent that today, you know, if you look at our vehicle lineup in US, were about approximately on a weighted average basis, 85% USMCA compliant. So like Elon said, this definitely gives us a bigger edge as compared to our other OEMs in terms of managing the tariffs, but we're not immune because when the Section 232 auto tariffs become effective in May, which includes Canada and Mexico, and Canada and Mexico has been part of our regionalization strategy, they will have an impact on profitability. And I know research modeling on this impact has been about a couple of thousand, give or take, which is pretty much in line with what we've been forecasting. The impact of tariffs on the energy business will be outsized since we source LFP battery cells from China. We are in the process of commissioning equipment for the local manufacturing of LFP battery cells in the US. However, the equipment which we have can only service a fraction of our total installed capacity at Lathrop. We've also been working on securing additional supply chain from non-China-based suppliers, but it will take time. Also note that, you know, Megafact, irrespective of all the impact on US from our energy, from tariffs on the energy business, we do have Megafactory China, which just started operations in Q1, and that should take care of our business outside of US. There's also an important impact of tariffs on our capital investments. I know this is going to sound counterintuitive since in order to onshore manufacturing or expand lines, we have to bring equipment from outside the US because there is not that much capacity in the US. And the current trade environment, you know, such equipment being brought in is subject to
the expense of bringing it in from China right now.
Exactly. And the reality is that China has the basic one which has the most capacity to provide this equipment. Our CapEx guidance, inclusive of model tariffs, even with the optimization we have tried to do, it is forecasted to be still in excess of $10 billion this year. We're still evaluating what more to do on this end. To summarize, we have near-term challenges in our business due to tariffs and brand image. We think our strategy of providing the best product at a competitive price is going to be a winner. And this is the reason we're still focused on bringing cheaper models to market soon, with start of production still planned for June. Additionally, the advancement in FSD-related features, including pilot robotaxi launch in Austin later this year, should help create a new era of demand. I would like to thank everyone at Tesla and our customers.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Vaibhav. Now we will move on to investor questions. We will start with questions from Say.com. First question is, what are the highest risk items on the critical path to robotaxi launch and scaling?
It is Ashok.
Yeah, we've got Ashok on.
Sure. Well, just disambiguate the cyber cab from Robotaxi once again. Teslas that will be fully autonomous in June in Austin will be Model Ys. That's currently on track. To be able to do paid rides fully autonomously in Austin in June. And then to be in many other cities in the US by the end of this year. It's very difficult. It's difficult to predict the exact ramp sort of week by week and month by month, except that it will ramp up very quickly. It's going to be like some basically an S-curve where it's very difficult to predict the intermediate slope of the S-curve, but you kind of know where the S-curve is going to end up, which is the vast majority of the Tesla fleet being autonomous. That's why I feel confident in predicting large-scale autonomy around the middle of next year, but, you know, certainly the second half of next year, meaning I predict that there will be millions of Teslas operating autonomously, fully autonomously, in the second half of next year. It does seem increasingly likely that there will be a localized parameter set for sort of you know, like that the if especially for places that have, say, very snowy weather, like say if you're in the Northeast or something, that like there's, you can think of it, it's kind of like a human, like you could be a very good driver in California, but are you going to be also a good driver in a blizzard in Manhattan? You're not going to be as good. So there is actually some value in, you can still drive, but your probability of an accident is higher. So it's increasingly obvious that there's some value to having a localized set of parameters for different regions and localities. But this is that put that in the nice to have category. It's not the required category. Again, the car is just very much like a human. It's digital neural nets and cameras, and humans operate with biological neural nets and eyes. And so the same strengths and weaknesses will be present for a digital neural net and cameras versus a biological neural net and eyes. Ashok, if you'd like to elaborate on that.
Yeah, and speaking to the location-specific models, we still have a generalized approach, and you can see that from deployment of FSD supervised in China, where with this very minimal data that's like China-specific, the models generalize quite well to completely different driving styles. That just like shows that the AI-based solution that we have is the right one, because if you had gone down the previous rule-based solutions or like more hard-coded HD map-based solutions, it would have taken like many, many years to get China to work. You can see those in the videos that people post online themselves. So the generalized solution that we are pursuing is the right one that's going to scale well. And you can think of this like location-specific parameters that Iran alluded to as like a mixture of experts. And if you're sort of like familiar with the AI models like Grok and others, they all use this mixture of experts to sort of like specialize the parameters to specific tasks while still being general. This makes the model use limited amount of compute to solve for the diversity of tasks that it has to solve. In terms of addressing the question that asked for, what are the critical things that we need to get right? One thing I would like to note is validation. Self-driving is a long-tail problem where there can be a lot of edge cases that only happen very, very rarely. Currently, we are driving around in Austin using our QA fleet, but then it's like super rare to get interventions that are critical for robotaxi operation. And so you can like go many days without getting a single intervention. So you can't easily know whether you are improving or regressing in your capacity. And we need to build out sophisticated simulations, including neural network-based video generation. That's all happening in the background to make sure that we deliver a safe product, and we are able to measure our safety, even though we can't just like see it by driving around the block or something like that.
In very basic terms, if we're seeing an accident every 10,000 miles, well, then you have to drive 10,000 miles on average before you get an accident or an intervention. So it's like, okay. Now imagine, I mean, we must be really, people must be very worked out by the sheer number of Teslas doing circuits in Austin right now. We're like, well, it's going to look pretty bizarre.
Some people are chasing us away.
Yeah. There's just always a convoy of Teslas going all over to Austin in circles. But I just can't emphasize this enough. in order to get figure out long tail things, if it's 1 in 10,000, let's say it's 1 in 20,000 miles or 1 in 30, then now you know the average person drives 10,000 miles in a year. So now try to compress that test cycle into a matter of, you know, a few months. That means you need a lot of cars doing a lot of driving in order to compress that or just do in a matter of a month what would normally take someone a year.
Yeah, and exactly. I would just also add that, you know, if you haven't looked at those videos coming out of China, people are
Amazing.
Yeah, they're putting it to real test. I mean, they're taking it to dirt roads.
Frankly, I think the Chinese consumer might be the most American consumer. And our customers in China are awesome. they have a lot of fun with the cars. I saw one guy take a Tesla on autonomously on a narrow dirt road.
Yes.
Across like a mountain. And I'm like, still a very brave person. And the Tesla's driving along on a road with no barriers. Where if he makes a mistake, he's going to plunge to his doom. But it worked.
Great. Thank you.
And if the question was on CyberCab itself, we're in B sample validation now.
Yeah. We should ask that question too.
Yeah. We have our first. Like big builds coming at the end of this quarter within Q2, and then, you know, in the coming months they start to large scale installation of all the equipment in Giga Texas, with, you know, still on schedule for production next year.
Yeah, and I just want to also clarify, because I think people don't understand, they think that there's no new building being built, and where is CyberCab going to
be? It's in the Giga,
it's in the same factory.
It's happening, and people don't know it's happening upstairs and all along the lines while we're still building the Model Ys and Cybertrucks every day.
It's worth noting that the Tesla Gigafactory in Austin is three times the size of the Pentagon,
including the garden.
Including the Ground Zero garden. So I go visit the Pentagon. I'm like, this building used to look big, but anymore.
Great. Thank you very much. The next question is, when will FSD unsupervised be available for personal use on personally owned cars?
Before the end of this year. Not necessarily, within the US, we do want to test, at Tesla, we're absolutely hardcore about safety. We go to great lengths to make the safest car in the world and have the lowest accidents per mile, and fewest lives lost. So we want to be very careful. We want autonomy to be definitively safer than manual driving. So it's not enough that it just be as safe. It needs to be meaningfully safer than if it's cars manually driven. So, and we want to confirm that there's not something. We just want to be cautious with the rollout. We don't want to jump in at the deep end with an army. But that said, I think we should be able to have it work in several cities later this year for personal use. The acid test being you should be able to, can you go to sleep in your car and wake up at your destination. And I'm confident that will be available in many cities in the US by the end of this year.
Great, thank you very much. The next question is Tesla still on track for releasing more affordable models this year? Or will you be focusing on simplified versions to enhance affordability, similar to the rear-wheel drive Cybertruck?
We're still planning to release models this year. As with all launches, we're working through like the last minute issues that pop up. We're knocking them down one by one. At this point, I would say that ramp maybe might be a little slower than we had hoped initially, but there's nothing, you know, just kind of given that turmoil that exists in the industry right now. But there's nothing that's blocking us from starting production within the next, within the timeline laid out in the opening remarks. And I will say it's important to emphasize that, as we've said all along, the full utilization of our factories is the primary goal for these new products. And so flexibility of what we can do within the form factor and you know, the design of it is really limited to the, what we can do on our existing lines rather than building new ones. But we've been targeting the low cost of ownership. Monthly payment is the biggest differentiator for our vehicles. And that's why we're focused on bringing these new models with the, you know, the lowest price to the market within the constraints I just highlighted.
Great. Thank you very much. The next question is, does Tesla see robotaxi as a winner-take-most market? And as you approach the Austin launch, how do you expect to compare against Waymo's offering, especially regarding pricing, geofencing, and regulatory flexibility?
Well, okay. The issue with Waymo's cars is it costs way more money. Room shot. what a bum. But that is the issue. You know, the cars are very expensive, made in low volume. Teslas are, you know, I don't know, probably cost a quarter or 20% of what a Waymo costs, and made in very high volume. You know, we're the ones that made the bet that a pure AI solution with cameras and audio, the car actually will listen for sirens and that kind of thing, is the right move. And Waymo decided that an expensive sensor suite was the way to go, even though Google's very good at AI. It's ironic. And you know, it is worth noting that Tesla's built an incredible AI, you know, AI software team and AI hardware chip design team. From scratch, from nothing. We didn't acquire anyone. We just built it. So, yeah, it's really, I mean, I don't see anyone being able to compete with Tesla at present. I'm sure that'll change eventually. But at least as far as I'm aware, Tesla will have, I don't know, 99% market share or something ridiculous. That 90-something%, at least, I don't know, at least something might change. But you know, if we have millions of cars deployed next year, and unless others have millions of cars deployed, we'll have, unless we're blocked by regulatory situations, it won't be long. I mean, in a few years, we'll have 10 million autonomous cars on the roads, then, you know, and counting.
I mean, the other thing which people forget is, like, we're not just developing the software solution, we are also manufacturing the cars.
Yeah.
And like, you know what, like Waymo has, they're taking cars and then trying to put
Waymo money.
we don't do that. So yeah, that definitely gives us a big leg up. And like Elon said, we already have a big existing fleet, which hopefully with the software update could become autonomous.
With the software update, it will become autonomous.
Yeah.
To be clear, the Model Ys that we're talking about in being autonomous in Austin in June are the Model Ys we make currently. There's no change to it.
I think people don't appreciate that the car which they can buy today,
the car that they have,
or the car they have, is capable of these kind of things.
In fact, it does drive autonomously from the factory to the end of line, every car.
Yeah.
Nowadays.
So in the US. Through the tunnel, the Model Ys, everything.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly. It is being put to use, it's doing useful work fully autonomously at the factories, as Ashok was mentioning. The cars drive themselves from end of line to where they're supposed to be picked up by a truck to be taken to a customer. And I'm confident also that later this year, the first Model Y will drive itself all the way to the customer. So from a factory in Austin and our one here in Fremont, California, I'm confident that from both factories, we'll be able to drive directly to a customer from the factory.
Cool delivery.
Yeah. Literally goes from the end of line and drives himself to your house.
It's important to note in the factories, we don't have dedicated lanes or anything. People are coming in and out every day, trucks delivering supplies, parts, construction, you know, for
And people can film it. By the way, you can see this from the road. Like it's not covered.
Exactly.
In this videos, people take videos online, and anyone who wants to go see it can just drive past our Fremont factory and see the autonomous cars driving themselves. Yeah, and they drive themselves and they put themselves in the exact right spot to be picked up.
Yeah, the logistics yard is right there in the open.
Yeah.
We don't move it again to another lane.
But they go to a specific spot, parking spot.
Yeah.
So that's just a routine, like everyday thing. Now.
Great, thank you very much. The next question is, can you please provide an update on the unboxed method and how that is progressing?
Sure. It's progressing, absolutely. As I mentioned just a minute ago, like it is the basis for our CyberCat manufacturing process. It's really what we changed in order to allow the low cost of production and also get the super high levels of automation. You know, really levels of automation that are sort of unheard of in the vehicle manufacturing scale. It's like not something that, you know, when you see it be produced, you'll think of in terms of like, wow, that's how a car has been built for 100 years. It's really something we've changed. In the past year, we've been like focusing on a lot of key development areas, like marrying these large subassemblies together in a precise way, in an accurate way. We've also de-risked things like corrosion of uncoated aluminum structures, you know, the sealing across the seams of the vehicle and when you marry assemble components. And we've even done early crash testing and proven that, like, you know, it's going to be just as safe as every other car we build. And so, like, we're, as I, you know, with all that combined, we kind of go into the builds that we have at the end of this quarter for the CyberCat product, and that's the next real big test of full scale, you know, integration of the unbox process. And that's kind of where we are. So you'll see them in test and on the test roads in a couple of months.
Yeah. And although the line won't be obviously at this rate
initially,
this is a revolutionary production system. I'm not sure what the right word is. Unboxing sounds like something like when you get your phone.
Can you open it up?
So you have like a pleasant experience when you take your phone out of the box. But which of course is nice, but this is much more revolutionary than that. This is a profound reimagining of how to make cars in the first place. No car is made like this anywhere in the world. The factory is the product as much as the car is the product. So it's really just the first principles approach to manufacturing that will ultimately allow us, I think, to, I'm trying to think, I'm confident ultimately it'll allow us to achieve a cycle time, meaning a unit every 5 seconds or less off a single line.
And we want to incorporate some of these for testing into our existing production lines as well to those with the line Cybertruck already.
So this is something I've been thinking about for a long time, and I've been thinking about this for a long time, and it's kind of it's not a crazy thing. Like a car every 5 seconds may sound like it's coming out like bullets, but actually it's coming out at walking speed.
It's like a meter a second.
We're still far away from caring about the aerodynamic drag of the manufacturing line, you know, because you're still at 3 miles an hour type of thing. You know, every 5 seconds sounds crazy, but it's 3 miles an hour that we're talking about. You can run away from it basically. But that's still by far the fastest line on Earth. You know, and it's like what's like the best single line on Earth? It's like about
Shanghai Phase 2.
And that's us?
33 seconds.
Yes.
And we're the fastest, right?
I would think so.
We think we're the fastest at 33 seconds in our Shanghai factory, but this would be, you know, 6 times faster or 7 times faster thereabouts. So, it'll be slower than that at first, but the point is that, like, when you fully optimize the design and operation of the next generation factory that we're building right now, a 5 second cycle time or less is the design is capable of it, you know. So if you when you go through like a radical new architecture, you go from like being like an A, I mean, I'd say like probably Shanghai in particular is an A plus on a moderately, you know, an advanced but still traditional car production system. Sort of, they're really doing about as good as possible to do within a conventional scenario. So trying to get much below, you know, below like 30 seconds, extremely difficult. But if not, and you start getting into sort of impossible, where you just you have to be faster than a human could possibly move. So then the autonomous line, it really just needs to be robots moving really fast. And that's where you get to sub 5 seconds. But we'll start off with getting a C in, instead of an A, getting a C in a new architecture. But then the potential is there over time to move that up to an A plus within an A plus architecture.
Great, thank you very much. The next question is, how is Tesla positioning itself to flexibly adapt to global economic risks in the form of terrorist political biases, et cetera?
As Elon said, you know, we've been supply chain team been at for a while. We continue to mitigate global economic risks like tariffs and political biases by regionalizing part supply near its factories in North America, Berlin, and Shanghai. For example, in North America, our high-volume vehicle programs have over 85% North America content, and Shanghai vehicles have over 95% local content. Berlin has similar levels of regionalization as North America, when you exclude the battery, and we are working on regionalizing the battery as well. This is a pre-pandemic strategy that we accelerated post-pandemic through supplier diversification, dual sourcing, vertical integration, advanced analytics, and local partnerships to ensure supply chain resilience and production stability. Having said that, we are not 100% insulated, and these tariff risks are higher on our low volume platforms than the high volume ones.
Yeah. In fact, there's no more vertically integrated car company than Tesla. I mean, we're the most vertically integrated car company since, Henry Ford back in the day when they were doing mining iron and stuff, and growing rubber trees. So, we're not growing rubber trees and mining iron yet, but we have built a lithium refinery in South Texas, and it's the, I think, the biggest lithium refinery outside of China, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
But it has output potential would be the biggest lithium refinery outside.
Yeah, and we've got space to expand it if we need to build more.
Right. So, and then we've got the cathode refinery in Austin next to the Gigafactory. Right. We're gonna figure out what to do about the anode. That's an ongoing subject of discussion. The best of all possible worlds would be figuring out how to have no anode. Best anode, best part being no part. That's the dream of the lithium batteries, to be anode, not have an anode. But either way, we better have the anode, the cathode, and the lithium, and the electrolytes, and the separator, to make a cell. But there's no other car company that is building lithium refineries and cathode refineries. We're ridiculously vertically integrated, and thus our best position to protect against supply chain disruptions.
Yeah.
Bonnie, do you want to talk about progress in the front?
Yeah, certainly for our in-house cells, we've multi-sourced every component, and we have. Every part coming from at least two different countries of origin, which is that we started this, the supply chain team and the engineering team worked together on this for the last couple of years to put that together. It's not something we did in a couple of months. You know, this is years of work. We're in a good position to take advantage of that. And the insourcing of lithium and cathode, they're the two most critical parts of the battery that's, you know, right in our backyard, and we're totally insulated from
oil. Well, they need to be in operation.
Days of being operation.
We also make our own cells, by the way. So right. Cell production, if you look, you have the, there's you make the anode, the cathode, the lithium, the electrolyte separator, the can, and then you got to put all that together in the cell factory. There are entire companies that all they do is produce cells, but they don't do the other stuff. They don't refine lithium or the cathode or, So our cell production is going quite well, and I think we're we're currently sort of the lowest cost per kilowatt hour.
Yeah, in the US. For all the cells we purchase in North America.
Yeah, so it's
lowest cost to us.
Yeah, so we have the lowest cost per kilowatt hour, all things considered. So the Tesla cell is the most competitive cell. For a kilowatt hour put into a car, if it's a Tesla cell, it's lower cost than if it's a supplier cell.
Yeah, and the plan this year is to really build off that base. You know, getting to lowest cost is it's the hardest challenge for the cell manufacturing. You know, it's relatively easy to build a flashy product that does one thing well. To build something at high volume and low cost is super difficult, and we're kind of using that as a base to then build off and add, you know, performance in different areas for new products coming out.
Yeah. So.
Can I come?
Yeah. I mean, to Elon's point, there's a lot of advantages for regionalization. You know, the most important thing is we're not tying up working capital for 6 to 8 weeks on the ocean. If there's a design change, then everything that's in transit basically has to be scrapped. Secondly, port disruptions, as we saw during COVID, can be very expensive because slight disconnects can shut down production. So then your only option is costly air expedite. It also gives us resilience in supply chain. If one region is down, we can bridge with others. It's more work to set up in the beginning, but it's critical to have when the need arises. Having said that, it's unrealistic to assume 100% regionalization across the board for specialized areas such as semiconductors. In such cases, our team works very closely with our partners to ensure we have strategic banks in place and a disruption doesn't impact production while we stand up the regional manufacturing for that particular commodity.
And, you know, I'll say, like, on the rest of the vehicle, like Elon was talking about with cells, we're also heavily vertically integrated, import ingots, you know, and turn them into castings. We recycle those and melt them. There's the same thing with plastics, but it doesn't mean we're not exposed. You know, we do have some areas where we use rare earth magnets, you know, that, and we've been working for years to find alternative sources and bring those up, as well as we have our induction machines. And as we've mentioned in the past, we're working on our ferrite numbers for some time. So, like, as Karn said, you know, with our heavy regionalization percentages, we're definitely like the lowest, you know, exposed to this, but we're not completely immune, as Bob mentioned in his opening remarks.
Great. Similarly related, on the battery side, does Tesla still have a battery supply constraint as noted on the Q4 call? And does that change with tariffs?
So this is Karn. We've been working very hard to expand battery cell production in the U.S., both with vendors and what Bonnie mentioned earlier with the 4680 program. And we're also working on moving the upstream supply chain for battery cells to the United States for several years. And that strategy is really starting to pay off now. As it stands right now, we're not constrained on battery cell supply for vehicles. The recent tariffs do pose some challenges to Tesla Energy, like our CFO mentioned earlier, but it's something we've been anticipating and we should be able to resolve in a timely fashion. We actually have a plan in place and we're executing towards it. We also have some other sources coming online to supplement the shortfall. And then, of course, we have the LFP production that's happening in-house. We have a slight disconnect of aligning the right cells with the right packs. So that's the little bit of puzzle that we have to solve internally. But as far as cells go, there's no shortage.
Great. Thank you very much. The next question is, did Tesla experience any meaningful changes in order inflow rate in Q1 relating to all of the rumors of brand damage?
So in Q1, as mentioned earlier, we took the best-selling car of the last 2 years and ramped up all four of our global factories. And in less than 8 weeks, we've already gone to the rate of our previous Model Ys, the factories. So just kudos again to the team for the great job there. And despite the economic strain and negative articles that in California in Q1, Tesla remained the best-selling car, not just EV. And additionally, we had a record number of test drives globally in Q1 as well. So interest remains high. And so right now we continue to see, you know, good interest still in the vehicle.
Yeah, I mean, Tesla is not immune to sort of the macro demand for cars.
Yes.
You know, so when there is economic uncertainty, people generally want to pause on buying doing a major capital purchase like a car. But as far as absent macro issues, we don't see any reduction in demand.
Correct. And that's where we continue to focus on affordability. And you know, it's a fun focus there.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you, guys. The next question is regarding the Tesla Optimus pilot line. Could you confirm if it is currently operational? If so, what is the current production rate of Optimus bots per week? Additionally, how might the recent tariffs impact the scalability of this production line moving forward?
I just want to emphasize, Optimus is still very much a development program. It's not a large volume production. That's why, this year, we'll make a few. We do expect to make thousands of Optimus robots, but most of that production is going to be at the end of the year. Almost everything in Optimus is new. There's not like an existing supply chain for the motors, gearboxes, electronics, actuators, really anything almost anything in the Optimus, apart from the AI for Tesla, the Tesla AI computer, which is the same as the one in the car. When you have a new complex manufactured product, it'll move as fast as the slowest and least lucky component in the entire thing. And as a first order approximation, there's like 10,000 unique things. So that's why anyone who tells you they can predict with precision the production ramp of a truly new product doesn't know what they're talking about. It is literally impossible. So you go through this like series of constraints where it's like this part's the limiting factor now, that part's the limiting factor now, this part's the limiting factor, and multiply that by 1,000 basically. And then the rate of the production ramp is decided by how quickly you can solve each of those problems. Optimus was affected, by the magnet issue from China, because the Optimus actuators in the arm do use permanent magnets. Now, Tesla as a whole does not need to use permanent magnets, but when something is volume constrained, like an arm of the robot, then you want to try to make the motors as small as possible. So we did design in permanent magnets for those motors, and those were affected by the supply chain. By basically China requiring an export license to send out any rare earth magnets. So we're working through that with China. Hopefully we'll get a license to use the rare earth magnets. China wants some assurances that these are not used for military purposes, which obviously they're not. They're just going into a humanoid robot. So it's not a weapon system. But that is an example of a challenge there. But I'm confident we'll overcome these issues, and we'll, by the end of this year, have thousands of Optimus robots.
Great. Thank you very much. And the last question we already covered earlier, whether Robotaxi was still on track for this year. So with that, we can move on to analyst questions. The first question is going to come from Pierre at New Street. Pierre. Please unmute yourself.
Hey guys, can you hear me?
Yeah.
That's great. So I'm super excited to hear Robotaxi and Optimus becoming the very tangible future for Tesla. But I have actually a question on the legacy, not the legacy, but the current auto business. And when I look back at the ramp of Model 3 a few years ago, I really saw it as being the iPhone of cars, a new product, completely reinvented, very different user experience, vastly superior, impossible to match for traditional competitors. And for the iPhone, it resulted in the high end of the smartphone market quadrupling in size, and actually Apple taking 60% market share. And so when you look at the Model 3 and the Model Y today, I think they are still like really vastly superior to any other cars. And I wonder why they've taken about 15% of their addressable market and not more, actually. So another way to put it is, why are there so many people still buying BMWs and Mercedes, knowing that the Model 3 and the Model Ys are out there and available? And I wonder if you're trying to solve that riddle internally, if you understand why, you know, what are these auto buyers who are not buying a Model 3 or a Model Y missing? And if you have ideas of things you could do to address that, maybe there is enormous value left on the table there. Yeah, that's what I'm wondering these days.
Yeah, the reality is that in the future, most people are not going to buy cars. So it's kind of what, you know, one could sort of say, look, if you want to continue with your phone metaphor, you can remember the days of the flip phones when there was, you know, 100 different flip phone designs, and I would, you know, the mistake that lump manufacturers made was to try to make many different variants of a flip phone, but which was a mistake. They should have made the iPhone. Because obviously everyone's going to want a smartphone. But in the beginning of when you know, the iPhone came out, I was like, wow, I can't believe these guys are not reacting as though this is death. But they didn't. They kept making variants of flip phones. Nokia, I think at one point was the most valuable company in the world or close to it. But they kept making flip phones. You know, trying to find another market niche. Maybe somebody wants a phone of a different style. Maybe this different color or whatever it is. Nope, they just want a super intelligent phone that can do everything. Just one. So, I said this many years ago. In the future, in the not too distant future, buying a gasoline car that is not autonomous will be like riding a horse while using a flip phone. Some people still do it, but it's rare.
Great. Thank you. The next question comes from Emmanuel Rosner at Wolf. Emmanuel, please unmute yourself.
Great. Thanks for taking my question. So Ilan, the public version of the FSD software still has a decent amount of, I guess, intermittent human interventions that are required. So what's still required for the software on your end to get to a level where it doesn't need to be supervised? And I'm asking that in the context of, obviously, the June launch being in the next couple of months. What still needs to happen?
And we are working on a number of items to
increase robustness. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, we are aware of the interventions that are happening in the public builds, and that's why we are hardcore burning it down. And really just picking some initial launch city helps us focus on like solving all the issues that you'd face here. For example, like we're focusing on Austin, we're not like solving all the issues that, you know, customers in Boston or somewhere else might face. And then here, we just like, you know, have a big list of all the issues, just burn it down. And that's what the team is working on, along with other sort of like redundancy issues. For example, if one of the computers goes down right now in the customer fleet, it would like throw the red hands and ask you to take over. But we don't want that kind of situation. So we're solving both like the reliability issues of the autonomy software and also the reliability issues of the system software together for Austin.
Yeah, really just work through a long tail of unusual interventions. So, and these are really very rare, like as a single intervention every 10,000 miles. I mean, that's a lot of driving you've got to do to even find one case where that happens.
Yeah, and some interventions are happening due to systematic missing functionality. For example, for handling emergency vehicles correctly, you don't need to consume audio as an input. But then the customer-facing versions don't have audio input, but the version that's in that's going to be in Austin will have audio input and so on.
Okay, but would you have like remote operators, for example?
I mean, every now and then, if a car gets stuck or something, someone will unblock it. But it's just because we are a bit conservative and tend towards more safety than even if we get stuck every now and then. We do have remote support, but it's not going to be required for safe operation. If anything, it's just required for more availability.
Anyway, it's only a couple months away, so you can just see it for yourself in a couple months in Austin.
Great. Our next question comes from Edison at Deutsche Bank. Edison, please unmute yourself.
Hi. Thank you very much for the question. So I want to ask about the Optimus supply chain going forward. You mentioned, very fast ramp up. What do you envision that supply chain looking like? Is it going to require many more suppliers to be in the U.S. now because of the tariffs? How does one kind of think about what needs to happen there?
We have to see how things settle out. I don't know yet. Right. I mean, so some things we're doing, as we've already talked about, which is that we've already taken tremendous steps to localize our supply chain. We're more localized than any other manufacturer, and we have a lot of things underway that to increase the localization to reduce supply chain risk associated with geopolitical uncertainty.
Did you have a follow-up, Edison?
Yeah. Wanted to come back actually to the robotaxi. Then, do you have a sense on how many cars or how big the scale will be initially and how that might ramp up? I know you're targeting millions of vehicles in the second half of next year. But initially at launch, how many vehicles would be reasonable? And is it going to be as simple as if one goes to Austin, let's say in late June or July, you'll be able to request?
Yeah. We're still debating the exact number to start off on day one, but it's like, I don't know, maybe 10 or 20 vehicles on day one. Watch it carefully, then scale it up rapidly after that. We want to make sure that we're paying very close attention the first time this happens. You'll be able to, end of June or July, just go to Austin and order a Tesla autonomous drive.
Great. The next question comes from George at Canaccord.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. It has to do with FSD pricing. Can we envision when you launch unsupervised FSD that there could be sort of a multi-tiered pricing approach to unsupervised versus supervised, similar to what you did with autopilot versus FSD in the past? Thank you.
I mean, this is something which we've been thinking about. I mean, just so you know, for people who have been trying FSD and who've been using FSD, they think even the current pricing is too cheap because for $99, you're basically getting a personal show.
Yeah. I mean, we do need to give people more time to if they want to look at, like a key breakpoint is, can you read your text messages or not?
Yes.
Can you write a text message or not? Because obviously people are doing this, by the way, with unautonomous cars all the time. And if you just go for a drive down the highway and you'll see people texting while driving, doing 80 miles an hour.
And putting the makeup on at the same time.
Yeah. putting on makeup, doing their hair with the mirror down and texting and driving at 80 miles an hour. This is a common occurrence. So, fuel, eating lunch, you name it, shaving, Right now the car is very insistent that you pay attention to the road, which reduces the value somewhat, because it's very rigorous about you paying attention to the road. And we'll gradually lighten up on that with, you know, every few weeks or every month, we'll relax that a little bit, make it so you can be more and more able to do things you want to do, and not have the car demand your rigid attention. So that value, it'll really be profound when you can basically do whatever you want, including sleep, and then that $99 is going to seem like the best $99 you've ever spent in your life.
Great. And George, do you have a follow-up?
My follow-up is about geographic expansion. Just maybe discuss additional markets. You know, there's been some news around India recently that you could launch this year and next. Thank you.
So, yeah, I mean, we've been working on getting into India. India is a very hot market. And especially the current, and I don't want to talk just about tariffs, but the current tariff structure with India is that any car which we send in is subject to 70% tariff. Also, like a 30%, you know, luxury tax on it. So, you know, the same car which we're sending is like 100% more expensive than what it is. So that creates a lot of, you know, anxiety. It's like, you know, people feel, okay, they're paying too much for the car. And by the way, we're not getting the money. The local government is getting the money. And that's why we've been very careful trying to figure out when is the right time. We, like I said, we are working on it. It would be a great market to enter because India has a big middle class, which we would want to tap in, and that is the market which we want to be in. But again, these kind of things create a little bit of tension, which we're trying to work around.
Great, thank you so much. The next question comes from Adam Jonas at Morgan Stanley. Go ahead, Adam. We can't hear you, Adam. So maybe we'll put you back in the queue, and we'll move to Colin Langan from Wells Fargo while Adam figures out his audio. Colin, please unmute yourself.
Oh, great. Do you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. You know, you're still sticking with the vision-only approach. A lot of autonomous people still have a lot of concerns about, you know, sun glare, fog, and dust. Any color on how you anticipate on getting around those issues? Because my understanding, it kind of blinds the camera when you get glare and stuff.
Actually, it does not blind the camera. We use an approach which is direct photon count. So when you see a processed image, so the image that goes from the sort of photon counter, so the silicon photon counter, that then goes through a digital signal processor or image signal processor, that's normally what happens, and then the image that you see looks all washed out because if you point the camera at the sun, the post-processing of the photon counting washes things out. It actually adds noise. So quite a big breakthrough that we made some time ago was to go with direct photon counting and bypass the image signal processor. And then you can drive pretty much straight at the sun, and you can also see in what appears to be the blackest of night. And then you know, in fog, we can see as well as people can, probably better, but I'd say probably slightly better than people, than the average person anyway.
So the camera is able to see when there's direct glare on it. I'm a little surprised by that.
Yeah.
Okay. And then just there were obviously media reports the other day that the affordable model was delayed. Doesn't sound like that's correct. Those reports also talked about it being more of a cheaper version of the Model Y. Any color on what we should expect? Is it a cheaper version of the Model Y, or is it actually going to be a design change with it?
So I think Lars already covered it in answering one of the say.com questions. The real thing which we are trying to focus on is affordability. And using our existing lines, and there's always limitations when you're using existing lines as to how many different form factors can you bring to. So that's the way I would say you should think about it. And I don't know if Lars, anything more to add?
Yeah, I think I said this before in other calls, like, you know, with the recent upgrades to the Model 3 and the Model Y platforms, we made some pretty great cars at pretty great prices, and we added a bunch of features and things like that. I think it's easy to consider that, you know, moving forward, Tesla doesn't make bad cars, and we always make, you know, our intent is not to make a car that is any worse than any car we've ever produced in the past. And so, you know, the models that come out in the next months will be built on our lines and will resemble in form and shape the cars we currently make, and you know, but the key is that they'll be affordable and you'll be able to buy one.
Great. We might have time for one last question. Adam, we'll try your audio again. You want to try to unmute yourself, Adam? All right. Unfortunately, still not working. There you go.
Sorry, guys. Technology.
Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, in the February 28th Joe Rogan interview, Elon, you advocated for a ramp in tariffs to give people time to adjust. Otherwise, in the quote, you said the system would break and bad things would happen. So are things breaking yet? And if the announced as if the tariffs as announced remain in place, when would things start breaking?
Well, at the risk of stating the obvious, I'm one of many advisors to the president. I'm not the president. So, I've made my opinion clear to the president, and and other people made their opinion clear to the president. He talks to many people, and he makes his decision, and you know, I'm hopeful that the president will observe whether my predictions are more accurate than the predictions of others, and perhaps weigh my advice differently in the future. We shall see. I'm an advocate of predictable tariff structures, and generally I'm an advocate for free trade and lower tariffs. Now, one does need to take a look at if some country is doing something predatory with tariffs, or is providing extreme support for, if a government is providing extreme financial support for a particular industry, then you have to do something to counteract that. I think that's on a case by case basis strategically. The president is the elected representative of the people and is fully within his rights to do what he would like to do.
So, okay, Elon, I respect that. Just as a follow-up, and thanks again. Between China and the United States, who, in your opinion, is further ahead on the development of physical AI, specifically on humanoids? And also drones, I'd be interested. And is it even close? And kind of how? Serious.
I think you know the answer to drones. a friend of mine, Naval, made this posted on X. I reposted it. I think a prophetic statement, which is any country that cannot manufacture its own drones is doomed to be the vassal state of any country that can. And we can't, America cannot currently manufacture its own drones. But that's it, Ken. Fortunately. China, I believe, manufactures about 70% of all drones. And if you look at the total supply chain, China is almost 100% of drones have a supply chain dependency on China. So China is in a very strong position. Here in America, and we need to shift more of our people and resources to manufacturing, because this is I have a lot of respect for China because I think China is amazing, actually. But the United States should not have such a severe dependency on China for drones and be unable to make them unless China gives us the parts, which is currently the situation. With respect to humanoid robots, I don't think there's any company in any country that can match Tesla. Tesla and SpaceX are number one. I'm a little concerned that on the leaderboard, ranks 2 through 10 will be Chinese companies. But I'm confident that rank one will be Tesla.
Great. Well, I think that's unfortunately all the time we have for today. We appreciate all your questions and look forward to talking to you next quarter. Thank you very much and goodbye.
All right. Hey, everybody. I'm just going to make sure we're all set up for the audio here. We'll do a couple of post-earnings call thoughts. If you guys can let me know that the audio levels are right, we can just go through some of what we heard on the call today. So, yeah, it looks like stock's holding up all right, kind of where we started, maybe a little bit higher than where we started prior to the call. So, doesn't look like anything too earth-shattering in either direction from the call. I think the biggest thing, as I said when the shareholder letter came out, which I would recommend the earnings report recap that we did earlier today, if you didn't check that out yet, link is in the description. But as we said when that came out, I think the biggest things from that letter were the reiteration of both the more affordable vehicles beginning production in the first half of this year, which obviously, as mentioned on the call, there had been media reports that maybe that wasn't going to be the case. It sounds like inaccurate. Lars did say, just with the industry-wide sort of chaotic situation that is happening right now with tariffs, et cetera, sounded like maybe the ramp would be a little bit more slow, happen a little bit more slowly than what they had initially hoped for, but it sounds like at least started production kind of still on track. I think that was the biggest thing, and then really tripling, quadrupling, quintupling, whatever you want to say, on the launch of Robotaxi in June in Austin. I think those are the biggest things that the market is looking for right now. It wasn't going to be so much what the specific earnings were this quarter, although as we talked about, I think the gross margins were a little bit of a small positive surprise. I think the operating margins and bottom line numbers were a little bit tougher, but that was largely driven by higher R&D, which as we talked about before, I think is generally a positive. That is very discretionary in terms of the spending that Tesla has to do there and can pretty easily fluctuate quarter to quarter, which could then result in a really strong number if Tesla chooses to dial back on that. But hopefully that R&D is a good spend that will lead to, you know, a positive result in the future, continuing to make the business something that grows and is even better going forward. So I think those were the biggest things from the shareholder letter. And I think those things were doubled down on again on the call and reiterated again on the call. So I think that's what the market is looking for. And as we get closer to June, hopefully we see that target hit. We see robotaxis unsupervised going around Austin. I wish someone would have specifically asked about safety drivers. I think my impression has been that there wouldn't be necessarily, but I think it would make a lot of sense to have safety drivers at first. I would certainly not have a problem with that, but if there are safety drivers, people will look at that as a half step and not take it seriously. So we'll see. It would have been a good question to ask explicitly, but they did talk a little bit about having capability for remote operators, but not something that they think is going to be very widely relied on. And they talked about intervention rates, and sounds like they're thinking that they're somewhere around 1 in 10,000 miles right now and really just trying to put miles on as quickly as possible to evaluate which version of FSD is performing better and things like that, things that we've heard Elon talk about on the calls before. It is nice to see that. I think we talked a little bit earlier today about just FSD. We haven't really seen an update for a while, and I think that is because their focus has been on Austin and getting this working in an unsupervised way, which I'm totally fine with. Get this working somewhere and then figure out how to expand it from there. Tesla so far has taken very much the opposite approach to that, and I think we're now at the point where the generalized solution has become so good, as evidenced by what we've seen in the US with version 13, the expansion capability of that that we've seen in China as well recently. I mean, there's some very impressive stuff happening there without even having the opportunity to localize any of that training yet. I think the generalized solution is proving to be an incredibly solid footing that will allow the type of scale that Tesla has always had in mind, that has always been the biggest reason for excitement behind this business in particular for Tesla relative to what competition has been pursuing and things like that. So I think that foundation is solid. I think now is the right time to then start to, you know, build from that foundation in these different localizations, do it in Austin, figure out how that works, and then figure out how to make that process work in a lot of other places as fast as possible. So I think that's where we're at right now. And if we can get the first step of that down, I think there's a lot of reason to be confident that those other subsequent steps happen quickly. And then I think Vaibhav made a really good point, CFO made a really good point there on the hardware. Like people just compare Waymo, compare Tesla, like Waymo's working here, Tesla's not working here, Waymo must be leading. But it's not that simple. It's never that simple. Cost is obviously a huge factor, which shouldn't be any surprise that Tesla's going to have a cost advantage there just based on, number one, their approach. But then the hardware piece of it is really important and really underemphasized a lot of times in those conversations. If Waymo were even ready to scale to a million vehicles per year, which they're not, they've been servicing the, let's say, Phoenix area now for multiple years, whichever geographies they're in, they've been in some of them for multiple years, and they don't even cover the entire region. Like, you go to the Phoenix airport, you can't even take a Waymo about 10 minutes west of there, something like, or maybe, yeah, 10, 15 minutes west of there. It hits the border of their service coverage area, and that cuts off a huge percentage of rides. If this solution is so good for Waymo and they're so far ahead, why can they not take their vehicles like 10 miles further west? It doesn't really check out very well to me. So you've got that. And then also, if Waymo were to then expand their service area, they then have to put up a bunch of capital up front, which I don't know what their cost per vehicle is. We've had studies over the years that have estimated like $100,000. People say that's dropping so quickly. I'm not sure that I fully believe that. But regardless, it's going to be more than $25,000 like it would cost Tesla, or even $35,000 if we're talking about a Model Y. It's going to be some significant percentage above that to be able to get that vehicle on the road. And when you have to then put millions of those vehicles on the road, pull out your calculator right now and do a couple million vehicles times $50,000. Like, that is a significant amount of capital to deploy up front for something that then Tesla could come in and potentially eat up your entire market, eat up your entire business model that you just planned around that CapEx spend, and force you to like go down market on your pricing. And then all of a sudden it just doesn't work. Like, you're not getting your ROI on your CapEx, and you just wasted $10 billion and you're out of business. Like, that's something that is possible and something that people don't really think about when they talk about this situation. So obviously it gets me a little bit heated because it's very surface level how people look at it a lot of times right now. So I think Tesla is in a great position if and when this does happen. As I've said before, I've been driving FSD 13 now for the last 4 months since I've got my Model Y, and it's been incredible. I think, you know, people look at like the FSD tracker out there. To me, that's nonsense. Like, having owned this vehicle now, any of that data is just complete nonsense. It's not, I think people are disengaging way too often, or like saying things that are safety critical when they're not really safety critical. I think Tesla's actual safety critical disengagement rate right now is very, very close to being at a level that is, you know, around human level safety and probably quickly approaching beyond that from my own personal experience driving the vehicle. Everyone else's could be different. That's my own strong opinion from my experience. So I'm excited about that stuff. Like, when we think about the automotive market in 5 years, 10 years, like, does it matter too much. Some of the things that relate to the earnings report this particular quarter and like tariffs and all of this other, it's not like it's nonsense, but I mean, you could hear at certain points where it's just like, man, do we really still have to keep talking about this stuff? Like, yeah, it's important, but this is like the past and the present, but like we're thinking about the future and we're so close to that, that this is really what needs to be the focus. I mean, Elon has felt that way for years and I think he's been right to feel that way, but like now we're literally within the quarter where this is supposed to happen and people are still asking about, like, you know, what's going on with some certain supply chain part or something like that. And it's just not, again, not that those things aren't important, it's just the relative importance is so much lower than you know, some of the other things that we could be talking about. And I think that's where some of that frustration then comes out. And for me, some of the boredom, if you were watching any of my reactions to some of those things. So yeah, I don't even necessarily, usually we go through like every single note here and see what's interesting. I don't really think there's too much that's really like new here. I mean, we learned a couple of details. I think the most interesting pieces of what we've learned have kind of been covered in what I've talked about already. I mean, the Optimus piece is definitely still important, but I don't think there's anything too new with Optimus on this call. They're just reiterating that, you know, hopefully we've got a few thousand at the end of the year. I don't personally care too much, like a few thousand, a few hundred, 50. I don't really care. What matters to me is that Optimus is being put in a position where it can be successful in the future. I don't think that someone's going to be ahead of Tesla on that for a lot of the reasons that we just talked about with Waymo and with Waymo and Tesla for autonomy. I think a lot of those same sort of things apply with humanoid robots too. And I think you see things from other companies that make them look like maybe they're in the lead, but no one really figures out, no one really goes through the entire analysis of the entire equation, which I think that will apply maybe even more strongly to Optimus than it does for vehicles. So anyway, I don't think it's anything like majorly new on Optimus, which is probably the other main focus. I mean, I guess it's good to hear Elon's thoughts on tariffs, and I think he was respectful on how he handled it, and he's voiced his opinion and not necessarily always in agreement with every single decision that is made by the administration. So I think that's just an important realization, and I wish more people could recognize that, you know, one certain political affiliation doesn't tie you to every single opinion of that political party. There's only two choices at the end of the day in the US. You gotta pick one, or you're picking neither and you're letting everyone else decide. So it kind of is what it is, and it would be ridiculous if every single person agreed with every single part of that political platform. So that's not how humans work. Everything's on a spectrum. So I think, you know, important for Elon to make those points, and I thought that he made them well. I laughed when someone said, I think Vyabhav said, that people think FSD is too cheap. I mean, on FSD, I bought FSD, I don't know, 2020, and then FSD transferred it into my new car. So for me, and I'm going to have this car for a long time, I assume, for me, like the cost per month over the life of ownership of my car over the last like 5 years or whatever it's been, it's well worth it, and it's only going to continue to be even more and more worth it as time goes by and as that gets amortized over more and more months of use. So I can't speak too much on the subscription, but yeah, I was just thinking the other day, and it's like one of the most fun things in my life, which is like kind of depressing to say it like this, but like, don't take it that seriously. One of the really fun things, one of the things I enjoy a lot over the last few years is just watching FSD progress, and it's progressed so extremely just in the last handful of years, and it's just been a lot of fun. I'm very grateful to just have been able to experience that, and it makes like every single trip that I have to do in my car interesting. So I don't know, it's well worth it for me. I'm sure others agree, and I'm sure others feel differently. So again, yeah, I don't know that there's a ton that I want to just sit here and go through. Obviously, most of this is like tariffs. Maybe we talk about the more affordable vehicles a little bit. I think they're signaling that it is going to be closer to the current lineup than maybe what people hoped. so hard to understand what that means. Like, could it be like a hatchback Model 3 or something like that? That seems like maybe some sort of like halfway different model could make sense, rather than just purely, oh, this is a lower trim vehicle. I think they're kind of like hedging around something like that. And that's my best guess at the moment. If it does end up just being cheaper Model Y, cheaper Model 3, and that's it, it looks the exact same, etc., that'll be disappointing to me, because I think that then just, to an extent, cannibalizes some of the sales of those more expensive vehicles that maybe people would have just bought those anyway, and now all of a sudden you just have less revenue and less profit without really growing volume in a super appreciable way. But we'll see. I mean, Tesla's got way more data to make those decisions than any of us do. So hopefully they'll make the right decisions in that regard, and I think that they will. But again, as Elon said with Robotaxi in June, I mean, we're a couple months away. We're going to know soon. So ramped Model Y already at the rate of the old Model Y. I think that was a nice little call out there. Not battery supply constrained. So Elon had said that this is something that they were looking at last quarter, which, you know, tough to understand exactly what the constraints would be. But Tesla's always, you know, having to manage a very complex supply chain into a diverse set of products, obviously. Talked about the new unbox system. I think good to note that initially Robotaxi in June is going to be Model Y. That's been my opinion for pretty much forever, so I'm not surprised by that, but I think people get their hopes up that it's somehow just all of a sudden going to be CyberCab. I think Franz had maybe said at one point that there'd be CyberCabs going around in June. I think he just misspoke and probably just meant to say Robotaxis when he said that, and just said CyberCabs on accident. So I've never really read into that too much. If anyone has questions, I'll go to questions soon, so just let me know. And I appreciate those super chats from earlier as well. Talked about the scaling of location-specific models, which I think makes tons of sense. Just continuing to read through the notes here. So CapEx, I think there's only about $1.5 billion of CapEx spend this quarter, versus this guidance for still in excess of $10 billion per year. So should see that ramp quite a bit. That'll obviously lower free cash flow in future quarters if that has to then average out to, you know, whatever 8.5 divided by 3 is, 2.8 or whatever. All right, so yeah, I think that's most of it. But if anyone has any questions, let me know. Otherwise, I think that call went a little bit longer than normal. So, Change Agent, thank you for the super chat. Appreciate that. Did Elon say they're going to start Robotaxi with 10 to 20 vehicles? Yeah, that's what it sounded like to me. It wasn't clear if that was like 10 to 20 literally day one, and then even a month later there could be significantly more, or if it would just be 10 to 20 and that's kind of what it is for a while. I don't think that was specified, but so starting with 10 to 20, like, I don't find that to be surprising. I think Tesla and Elon have consistently said, we're going to start small, make sure that there's no major issues, and then expand over time, which is the right way to go. I think after it's been so long and there have been, you know, so many promises of FSD coming to fruition, or maybe not promises, but predictions of FSD coming to fruition, and now that we're like finally on the precipice of that potentially happening here in June, I think people just get really excited for it to be this all at once thing, which I don't think it's going to be. I think it's still going to take a long time, and starting with 10 or 20, I think it's a good starting point. I've been in the stock for 12 years. I'm certainly patient enough to wait, you know, a year or two more, when I continue to believe Tesla's got the leadership position and really the only one position to be able to capitalize on doing this at scale. Like, okay, go forward 2 years, even if Tesla still hasn't like solved it or scaled it by then, like what, Waymo's going to be in like 20 cities with like a few thousand cars by then. It's just, there's not going to be that sort of competitor, China sort of notwithstanding, because obviously their progress is strong, and if there were going to be someone that figures it out, it seems like it would probably happen in China, but I think that's kind of the case in a lot of industries these days. Joe, thank you. For Robotaxi is Model Y, what are those new castings that Joe Tegmeyer saw today? Yeah, I think those could be, I don't understand the lingo that Lars was using in terms of their sort of like B production run for Cybercab, but I think those things could be for Cybercab. Tesla's going to be going through the process of scaling that up. It sounds like right now they're doing a lot of things that precede the full-scale installation of the line. So it could just be a small pilot line right now that's, you know, some of these things are either being done for or done on. It's, you know, I don't have enough manufacturing experience, which is zero, to be able to answer that question. But that's my guess. It's just castings for Cybercab, and it relates to the, you know, pilot production process. Potentially it could be for these other vehicles, but based on what they had said today, that seems a little bit less likely. That being said, like, seeing these things now definitely doesn't mean that they're Cybercabs in June and they're just, you know, not telling us about it as a surprise. What's your take on the strategic value of Elon being involved with the Trump administration? Everyone's going to have a pretty strong opinion on this. I think there's obviously potentially benefits of it. I think there's, you know, as they talked about today, potential downsides, certainly in terms of vandalism and brand and things like that. How it washes out is, I think, too early to call, which people can criticize me for that and probably will, even to just say that maybe it's too soon to call, but we'll see how it plays out. I don't think it's something that is gonna ruin Tesla or anything like that. Like, I'm sure people have that opinion. That's not an opinion that I would share. So we'll see. I think anything, when you start to get into a political topic in nature, I don't really like doing that in sort of a format like this, where it's not a dialogue and there's no back and forth and opportunity to, you know, hear someone else's point of view and then share my point of view in that context. And that's just not really how I like to discuss those things, that people get really, you know, passionate and sometimes heated or emotional or whatever about. So I wish there was like a way to do that and still have it be broadcast and whatnot, but I'm not sure I've got a good answer for that. So unless I just sit here and we talk about politics for 10 hours, then it's probably not super fruitful, which I don't know. Maybe I should just do that. somebody asked, whatever happened to Elon, the interview proposition with Elon some years ago? Yeah, I see people like giving Elon a hard time for this on X sometimes. Please don't do that. That's not really a good look for any of us or for me, because people don't have any idea what the context is. So I'm still hopeful that that'll happen someday. I think I have not probably been as aggressive as following up with it. I think a lot of things timing-wise were not something that I thought really made sense. Not to say that I wouldn't have still done it and probably should have pushed harder for it, and not that there was zero effort on my end either. But I just think if I had pushed harder, maybe it would have been something that had already happened, and my hope is that someday that will happen. So I don't sit here and think like that's Elon's fault or something, and I don't want other people to think that either. With timing, it was like, you know, we're kind of going into that Twitter situation, and it's like, is now the right time for a Tesla Daily interview? I don't know. Didn't really seem to make a lot of sense. So, but again, you know, hopefully that changes at some point. Brandon, I see you say you stop badgering me. I don't know if you're talking about me, but if I see whatever your question is, I'll answer it. All right, I just still reading through, and then I do have to wrap up here pretty soon. Shareholder meeting date, not sure. Don't think that's published yet. Sometimes, usually in the summer. Oh, gotcha, Brandon. gotcha now. I mean, you can ask if he still wants to do it. Nothing wrong with that. But I just sometimes I've seen people not asking and more criticizing. Any chance of bringing Tesla Daily back? I got to really update the name of this channel on my graphics and stuff. I don't think there's much chance of Tesla Daily as it was coming back. I honestly don't have time for that. And, you know, with everything with First Principles Group and whatnot. But I don't know. As I said last quarter, it's nice to come back at least once a quarter. I'm potentially open to doing more. I'm not sure what that looks like, or, you know. It's something I think about. As I've said many times, I was super burned out on content creation. I still don't really enjoy all of the content creation aspects of it. Like, attention-seeking behavior it's like oil and water for me. And that's part of the game. So I really don't like that. But I don't know. Maybe I can figure out ways where it still works. Belugi the Beluga. Awesome name. Thank you. Appreciate it. All right. I think I'm going to wrap it up. I hear the feedback, though. You guys want something that's not just quarterly. I'll continue to take it under consideration. No promises, but maybe we can figure something out that works. It's something I'm thinking more about as I get a little bit more removed from what was a long, long, long daily grind. But appreciate you guys. Appreciate your support. Appreciate you still tuning in to join me on my legacy, once a quarter channel. It does mean a lot to me. It's always nice to see, you know, the numbers on the streams and things like that, and all the really nice comments. It means a lot. It really speaks volumes just that how awesome this community is and can be. And I appreciate it. I said before, one of the most fun things in my life, and this is definitely one of those as well. And I feel really grateful for it. So before I get any more sentimental, we'll wish you guys adieu for now, and definitely at minimum we'll be back next quarter, and hopefully even before that, hopefully we've got something to talk about with Austin, and I don't know if they'll do like a RoboTaxi event or something, or maybe we'll see a shareholder meeting even before Q2, not sure, but we'll be back soon, no matter what. So again, thanks everybody, I appreciate it, and we'll talk soon.